The Business on RTÉ Radio 1 with AIB. We know that your focus is on your business. That's why ours is on supporting you.
Well, born and bred in Derry, my first guest had a broad and colourful career that started at the age of 14 when he got his first job delivering papers for the Belfast Telegraph. Within a few months, he'd recruited six of his peers to work under him. Since then, he's worked in a number of roles which have included being the city centre manager for Derry, a mediator on the Parades Commission, chief of the Vintners Association, head of an international marketing company, one of the organisers of an electronic dance festival, and his current role as CEO of Manufacturing Northern Ireland. Stephen Kelly, you're very welcome to the programme.
Morning, Richard.
I'll come back to the raves and the electronic dance festivals a little bit later on, but first to the Northern Ireland Protocol, and we're hearing there the talks are intensifying in relation to a deal. I'm not going to ask you if you're optimistic that a deal can be reached, because the main protagonists here have probably concluded the bones of a deal weeks ago. It's all a question of whether or not an acceptable deal to the Eurosceptics in Rishi Sunak's Tory party and an acceptable deal to Unionists, primarily the DUP, can be achieved.
Yeah, you're right, Richard. There was a bit of an expectation that perhaps that towards the start or middle of this past week, the UK would have come to its final conclusion on this, but it's looking like some sort of landing can happen in the days ahead. And certainly there's a lot of speculation in the UK and in the North that that may be as early as Monday. But I don't think we're in a place where everyone's content. I don't think we're in a place where the Prime Minister's fully ready to commit to this. There may be some twists and turns as the next couple of days go by.
What was the Prime Minister like, Stephen? What was he like? You were actually chatting to him within the last week, and there was a sense that things were moving in a particular direction, and then there was a bit of a wobble. Did he seem to have a bit of a wobble to you?
I have to say he was incredibly engaged with the issue. He was very impressive in terms of the detail. He was able to understand nuance and make connections between some of the choices and decisions that are having to be made. He was able to directly quote from some of the things that people in the meeting had even said and connect those back into the types of solutions that he's trying to negotiate.
And that was encouraging for you, because you were probably contrasting that with some of his predecessors.
Well, that's correct. I wouldn't say that his previous two predecessors were across the detail as much as he certainly was. And I suppose we're at a point now where we've some of the what we probably need is some of the razzmatazz that perhaps Boris had, but some of the real detailed understanding and comprehension that the current Prime Minister has. And it's whether now the Prime Minister believes that he's in a position that he can sell this to his party and potentially to the DUP in the country.
And Stephen, how do you manage the politics of all this? Because you're running an organisation that represents different businesses, different manufacturing companies across Northern Ireland, probably very different views about politics, about the future makeup of Northern Ireland, about Brexit even as well. How do you pull all that together and have an agreed position?
Well, being in the North in business is tricky. Living in the North has always been tricky. Growing up, it was certainly the case. But all you can do is actually assess what people are saying to you, bring those together in kind of large threads, and then just relentlessly speak the truth. Whenever you continue to speak the truth, whether that's in the interest of the audience that's in front of you or not, is irrelevant. All you can do is speak the truth. And yeah, you're absolutely right. People here have different constitutional aspirations. People here have different impacts in terms of what the protocol or Brexit has on them. But everybody's actually in the same place, which is yesterday they had wages to pay. When they get up on Monday morning and they go to their office or their factory or whatever else, that's what their focus is. They want to create products that they can sell to markets at home and abroad, because they have a responsibility towards the people that they pay on a Friday.
You grew up in Derry City and would have been growing up during the Troubles as well. And you've had a kind of, as I was saying, a long and interesting career. So let's just start at the beginning. What was it like growing up in Derry during the Troubles? One would imagine that people would say, you know, if you were a kid, you're a kid and that's all you know. But on the other hand, you were always in sort of close proximity to something that was very quite chaotic and at times dangerous.
Well, it was. I was born in at the end of 71, and at 2 months old, I was in my granny's flat in the Roswell Flats in Derry during Bloody Sunday, and a bullet came through the window of her flat. I always remember, even as a young child and growing up, there was always this kind of focus on this bullet hole at the back of my granny's flat. So that's a kind of demonstration of how difficult those days were.
What happened to the bullet, Stephen? Was it removed, or was it part of any follow-up inquiries or anything? There was just the hole left, was there?
There was just a hole left, yeah. I don't actually recall a bullet being lodged in her wall for those years. So obviously it was removed at some point. But yeah, it was an incredibly difficult place. Chaotic was a good description, but actually dangerous as well. I mean, you couldn't kind of behave as we would normally behave these days in terms of navigating around the city or crossing the border, for that matter. It was always a very tricky experience as well.
But you came close to being blown up at one stage.
We did actually. Was visiting, not my own granny, but a friend of mine's, and in the Roswell Flats again, and there was lots of activity happening in and around. And the flats had like three walkways on the third, fifth and seventh floor, and we were on the fifth. And just as we were kind of walking along, there was this older lady with a statue of Our Lady, and we were wondering what was happening. And at that point, the flat directly above us was blown up, and the debris went around us, but because we were in this walkway, we were cocooned from all of that. So you didn't need to travel too far during the 70s, 80s and early 90s in Northern Ireland to actually experience some pretty difficult and horrendous scenes.
And there's been so much publicity around the very successful, very brilliant Derry Girls TV show. And very often when somebody makes a programme about a place, the people from the place don't like it because they say, oh, that's not really what it was like. But lots of people in Derry say, no, Derry Girls, that was it. What's your take on that?
I wasn't sure whether it was a drama or whether it was a documentary, Richard.
It was that close,
yeah. There's a rawness to this part of the world, which actually forms part of our character, and we're very proud of it. And I think Derry Girls and Lisa McGee, the writer, very skillfully navigated that and has presented, in our own voice, presented a programme to the world that really reflects what it was like to be a young person in this part of the world and in this city during that period.
But it has also done a lot for the city. I mean, it to some extent, Derry has done its own thing vis-a-vis Belfast, but has also suffered economically over many years, whether it's in relation to education, tourism, all kinds of things because of that. But Derry has really, or Derry Girls has really lifted it a lot, hasn't it?
It really has. I had the great privilege of being in the White House last St. Patrick's Day, and you kind of go in and you sit yourself down and you're trying to work out who everybody is around you. And the first people that I sat beside, we started talking to them, and they instantly started talking about Derry Girls. They were just fascinated by the programme, really looking forward to the second series. And it kind of really brought it home to me how far that programme actually travelled. Now, they did have to watch the programme with a bit of subtitles. The language was a bit difficult for them to pick up, even as Americans. But that programme really resonated with the world. It has really enchanted people in all corners of the world and has travelled much further than I think perhaps even Channel 4 and Lisa herself expected it to be.
When you think about how far down the road of improvement things have gone in the north, you know, nearly 25 years since the Good Friday Agreement. And then we have the incident in Oma, the shooting of John Caldwell, senior police officer. And there's a rally today and there's a huge response to that. Does your heart sink a bit? And I don't just mean obviously in terms of personal empathy for that man and for his family, but also for the wider narrative around the north.
Well, it does. I mean, this place has transformed in the last 25 years. It is unrecognisable physically. It's unrecognisable emotionally. And incidents like the horrendous incident in Oma the other day really kind of, if you allowed it to, it would really depress you really quickly. But more important than anything was the response to that. Our political leaders got together, despite their own difficulties, really quickly. The community has been rallying around, not just the people in Oma and the Caldwell family, but even the PSNI as well. This place is psychologically in a different place than what it was back in 1998. And that's huge credit to not just the political leadership, but people in business, people in civic society and the communities themselves.
Sometimes from the outside, when you listen to political rhetoric and sometimes incidents on the news, that sort of thing, particularly post-Brexit, and Brexit seems to have been very, very divisive and in many ways set things back, it gives the impression that there's still a very, very long way to go and maybe not that much has changed. On the other hand, when you live in Northern Ireland and you spend a lot of time in the north, you live there, I spend a lot of time there, the way that people live their lives is quite different, and it isn't really what you hear about on the news.
Well, it's certainly not. This is a very warm and welcoming place. I just come into the studio here at your colleagues at BBC Foyle. I drove through the city centre and there's tourists walking around the streets. We have these extraordinary medieval walls that are welcoming visitors from all over the world. People come and stay here and just fascinated by the character of the place. And it isn't what people hear and see on the news, perhaps worldwide. And I actually had the CNN's international diplomatic editor call me and say how worried he was about what was happening in Northern Ireland. And I said, well, when's the last time you've been here? This place isn't what you remembered it during the Troubles. This place isn't the type of narrative that perhaps you're picking up in, certainly in UK media, maybe international media as well. We're all in a different place here. We're pointed in one direction, which is we've got families and we've got lives to live and we want to make sure that those are as prosperous as possible.
When it comes to cross-community work, you've had sort of experiences with the other community from very early on. I mean, in one case, you had a memorable visit to a drinking club on the Shankill Road. Tell me about that.
Well, I had the great benefit of actually attending an integrated school here in Northern Ireland, and I know that maybe sounds alien to many of your listeners, but it was not the usual route in many respects. So I've always had an experience where I'm talking and engaging with people from all communities. But yeah, during the height of the Drumcree dispute, actually, I was working for a cancer charity here in the north, and I was asked to go and collect some money from a drinking club up the Shankill Road. It's one of those very no windows, very narrow doorway. So I go in to collect the money, and of course I'm stopped and instantly asked, where are you from? That accent's not from around here. Now, in the past, that was always a tricky moment for anybody from Derry, because your accent kind of defined who you were. And you have that kind of choice to make at that point in time. Do I lie and say I'm from Strabane, or to be honest with myself and with the people I'm talking with and actually tell them I'm from Derry? So I chose to do that, and it was almost like one of those moments in a Western movie when the piano player in the corner stops playing and everybody goes silent. And you could see that the person I was talking to, it really kind of took him back that there was somebody standing in front of him who was so honest with him and didn't try to lie. But I had a brilliant experience with those people. They recognised I was there for a very good cause. They were very proud of what they'd done in terms of raising the money for the charity. And I spent a brilliant afternoon talking with them about what they'd done and the impact of the money that they'd raised would actually have on patients.
And then later on, you were on the Parades Commission in the sort of early days of the commission, and you would have been the first person in many ways to get the Orange Order in Portadown to engage. How did you do that?
So I wasn't on the Parades Commission as such. They had these kind of field workers called authorised officers, and I was appointed as one of those. And you kind of draw a line from Kilkeel on the east coast to Castledarg, right on the western part of Northern Ireland. Everywhere south of that, I looked after alongside another colleague. So you're kind of handed these forms of these contentious events, and on the form is the name and telephone number of the organiser. So the very first form comes in for a parade in Portadown on the lower part of the Gairvahy Road. I picked up the phone and I rang the guy and I said it would be good to meet up, and he said, yeah, that's great, fine, come down and see me. He went down to Carlton Street Orange Hall in Portadown. They closed the door behind me, a bit awkward, and I asked him, well, why did you agree to meet? And he says, you're the first person to ask me to meet. There's always this assumption that whether it was in that industry or whether it was in any business, that that everybody already knows the answers, either yes or no, and so don't ask the question. But the fact that I had actually taken the effort to ask the question, the first person to do that, he said he would be happy to meet. And that was a bit of a breakthrough for the commission, because they'd never actually engaged with anyone, certainly from the Orange and Portadown at that point in time. And it was a bit of a moment there, and I just blundered into it more than anything else, just by asking the stupid question, the only chance we could meet up.
Do the obvious thing, which often isn't obvious.
Well, that's it, and I think there's a lesson in life for that, is just don't assume the obvious, just ask the stupid question. You get at least one free chance to ask the stupid questions. No. And it transpired from there that we did establish relationships. Portadown Orange eventually, the leadership there went to South Africa with us on safari with people from business and civic society and the churches in Portadown, and we had a bit of a conversation. We were there. Now, it hasn't resolved the Drumcree dispute, but certainly Drumcree's not on the headlines anymore.
Well, I won't ask you whether there was any rave music at that event in South Africa, but you are into electronic dance music, and you organise raves.
I do, and people kind of wondering how on earth you end up in those scenarios. But and the great benefit of having some really good business coaching and life coaching, and I was asked the question by the coach about where you get your energy from, and it sounds quite an innocuous question in many respects, but what he was basically getting at is that in life we have loads of things that just consume our energy. And it's really important that we begin to jettison those things and lots of things that actually give you energy. So out of that coaching session, I resigned from a number of things that was just taking up time and just zapping me, and I didn't really want to be involved. And I was asked to kind of help some local young guys put on these rave events. And they kind of came to me because of kind of a bit of a history of actually finding a way to make things happen that perhaps people think that are impossible to happen. So yeah, I got involved. I thought it was going to be a couple of quick phone calls, but it turned out to be about 3 weeks' worth of hard work. And we were putting 2,000 young people in a underground multi-story car park, turned it into a nightclub. And some of the loudest experiences I've ever had in my life. My ears still ring today, Richard.
I was going to say, do you still dance at any of them, or is that just, are you finding that more difficult?
As the years go by, I'm finding it more difficult. Yeah, there's no doubt about that.
Honesty once again. Stephen Kelly, CEO of Manufacturing Northern Ireland, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.